The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
So, this is your host, Soraya, and tonight, on the first show of 2014, we have someone who's been probably our most regular guest. He's done two full shows with us and a few podcasts midweek. We have Mr. Micah Hanks back. And welcome to the back to the show, Micah.
Well, Happy New Year, Sarai. It's always good to be here catching up with you, riffing on whatever's going on in the world of esoterica.
Well, one of the things going on is you have this book, The Ghost Rockets.
Oh, yeah. I heard that you read it eventually or had reviewed it. Well, I guess that entails reading it, too. So you read and
indeed.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Mystery Missiles and Phantom Projectiles in Our Skies. It was a little different than I had expected.
Yeah, you know, because I think a lot of people probably have. Well, actually, first I'll ask you, what did you expect of the book? And then I'll tell you what I think most people get from it.
Well, my familiarity with the Ghost Rockets is the stuff Kiel covered, which was the Sweden waves. Mm-hmm. And I was expecting stuff pretty much along those lines of these mysterious, seemingly missiles or rockets that no one could ever find any trace of. Whereas you went all over the map with it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, as a matter of fact, when the book was first announced, Lauren Coleman, not just cryptozoologist, but of course, you know, Fortean all round extraordinaire, Lauren tweeted at me and he said, ah, ufology before it was ufology. And of course, what he's referencing is what in the first chapter of the book I do talk about. And that is the wave of rocket and missile sightings of unexplained origin that occurred over Sweden in 1946. And what's interesting about that is that while there are skeptics, and one noted skeptic, and a guy who I've met and talked to, and I actually respect, he's written for Fate magazine over the years, and as well as a lot of the more skeptical publications, but Bob Schaefer, who used to work very closely with Philip J. Klass, you know, he has examined the ghost rocket thing, and he lends to this what I think most proper historians would, and that is the perspective that there was probably a lot of war nerves, you know, or war nerve-esque psychological phenomena going on. And if you're unfamiliar with the term, anyone out there, what we're talking about is just immediately after the Second World War. If you're in Europe, naturally people were concerned about the possibility of a new war erupting, possibly between the Western Allied powers and Russia, who emerged as a superpower following the Second World War. The rocket propulsion programs that had been captured from Germany that were split up between Germany or Russia and Britain and the United States. All these kinds of things led to a lot of concern immediately after the war. People weren't sure how long peacetime maybe would be withheld or maintained. And so naturally, over these neutral countries, it was interesting for a couple of reasons that there were apparently rocket sightings that were occurring. One being that, well, these were countries that were neutral in Scandinavia throughout the war, especially Sweden. But then also, the fact that the Swedish government took enough interest in these reports that they decided to, yes, launch a full-fledged governmental panel that would investigate this. And this was, in historical terms, the first institution of a ufological study group under a government, under a country's government. So, you know, with the ghost rocket story, yes, it begins in 1946. And that's why I chose to, despite the fact that I look at a lot of unexplained missile incidents throughout the book, some of them that I don't think you could even in any way call them ufological. We start with something that in UFO research has often been examined in that ufological context, and that's where the term ghost rockets comes from. And since it's familiar to UFO researchers, I use that term, and then after beginning with the 1946 experiences, which is funny because actually, although the epicenter of that in 1946 was, you know, Scandinavia, the first incident that's actually discussed in the first chapter was a case that was in the summer of 1946 that occurred here in the United States over the state of Florida, I believe, when Captain Puckett was his name, a man named Puckett had been flying along with his crew, and they had seen a large rocket-shaped craft that almost slammed into their aircraft as they were flying toward MacDill Air Force Base. So, you know, again, it's a global phenomenon that's examined. Then throughout the rest of the book, yes, we look at a lot of more conspiratorial missile-related incidents, including TWA Flight 800, an incident that has fascinated me. And having studied the official explanation, having seen the new documentary about it, that I think brings some very compelling evidence. And keeping in mind that I'm not a person who gravitates typically, Soraya, toward those conventional conspiracy theories, the alternatives to the official narrative. Like with 9/11, we've talked about a lot of this in the past when you and I have chatted. And with 9/11, you know, I think that most of the official explanation is probably what happened. I think that there are just a few anomalies. One of the biggest ones is the fact that Congress had requested an investigation, and when this investigation was supplied, there was the results in an actual official report, there were about 7,200 words that were redacted. Those who have seen the redacted portion say that there's an incredibly strong tie-in with Saudis, and that there's a Saudi connection that is almost inescapable, and yet it seems that this may have been withheld from the public. There are certainly aspects of 9/11, I think, that are a cover-up without having to say that the entire thing was an inside job or a false flag. Same thing with TWA Flight 800. Obviously, I think that the investigation came to a determination that is in contrast to some of the evidence that has emerged over the years. And in the book, what we look at are a number of what appear to be missiles and rockets that were seen in the area around the same time as the TWA Flight 800 aircraft went down. And so why haven't these, and even this new documentary didn't choose to address the rocket reports, one of them that was chronicled very well by Peter Davenport at the National UFO Reporting Center. Why weren't these things taken into consideration in conjunction with the craft going down and people saying that they saw what looked like a flare or a rocket going toward it? And then, yeah, toward the end, we get back around to what some might call a ufological component, because we dig into NASA's Aviation Safety Reporting System database and pull forth a number of reports where people either in aircraft or pilots themselves flying commercial aircraft describe seeing what look like rockets and torpedoes as recently as just the last few years. So obviously, to me, there's still a phenomenon that has to be considered here, whether we're dealing with drones, actual missile technologies, or something else. It's probably a variety of different things that all culminate under this term that I chose to use, which was the conventional ufological ghost rocket. And I think a lot of people look at this book expecting, oh, it's going to be about the 1946 Scandinavian sightings. There's a much broader phenomenon here.
All right. What do you think of the 46 sightings yourself? Do you think that they had a ufological component, or do you think it was just war nerves?
Well, I think it's both. And when I say a ufological component, these are obviously unidentified flying objects, but that term colloquially hadn't, or otherwise, or officially even, was not in use at that time. There had been officials in the United States also who had taken serious interest in the ghost rockets incident, which is one of the only criticisms maybe I've gotten about the book, is that they say, you know, you didn't really spend a whole lot of time talking about the U.S. interest in what was going on in Sweden at the time. And the reason why is because, of course, you know, within the context of the book, in order to give a chronological survey, which in order to present this chronologically and look at these reports, there is a rather exhaustive an index in the back of the book that lists chronologically virtually every report of a missile-like or a rocket-like incident that I could comb through databases and websites, periodicals, newspapers, magazines, and gather, and they're presented there as, you know, to give a sort of a timeline of the rocket phenomenon that has been reported over the years. And no doubt there are numbers, hundreds or more of incidents that went unreported or that are more obscure that I didn't manage to find. But that's probably the most exhaustive survey that I know to exist that's presented there in the back of the book. But that said, I think that war nerves certainly contributed to what was going on in 46. People were obviously on edge. But also, in likelihood, and what my theory is, and I even hint at this in the book, it seems very likely to me that knowing that Britain and the U.S. and that Russia had managed to obtain rocket technologies that that the Germans had been developing and using with deadly precision during the Second World War. It seems very likely to me that over the neutral countries of Scandinavia, somebody was probably administering tests with these ballistic devices, with these rocket devices, or some similar technology. Guided missiles maybe were being tested, and there may not be an official explanation for who was conducting these tests or why they were being conducted, but I mean, again, I think that if we see a technology that at that time was only in its infancy still, but had nonetheless been, war approved and field tested during the conflict, it seems obvious that we were looking at a physical earthbound phenomenon. We just didn't know where it came from. And I doubt sincerely that any of the officials on the panel that the Swedish government formed. As a matter of fact, there was a his name escapes me at the moment. Eric, may have been Eric Malmberg. I'll have to double check that. But he had been quoted years later talking about the fact that those of us on the panel, most of us were convinced, even though they came to the determination about what was happening, very similar to that of the Condon Committee, that they said that there was no scientific evidence that they could retrieve and present that said with certainty that there was an actual phenomenon. But the panelists, despite having physical scientific proof, they nonetheless felt strongly that there was a phenomenon. And furthermore, he said the thing is that what was being described was some sort of a cruise missile or guided missile technology, but in 1946, in that part of the world, it didn't exist yet. And so to me, what it points to is the idea of there being secret weapons and aviation technologies that were being developed. I don't think people were crazy, and I don't think that the plethora of reports, sometimes numbering literally, you know, dozens per day, in certain parts of you know, Sweden, especially in Scandinavia, throughout that summer, you know, July, June, July, August, I suppose, of 1946, the number of reports that were coming in to me precludes the possibility that it was completely war nerves. But by the same token, with the publicity that was occurring, and the government tried not to allow all these reports out so the media wouldn't be putting too much information out and thus be inciting panic. But nonetheless, the reports were getting around by word of mouth as well. People knew what was going on. The reports of rockets were prolific. And so if meteors or other objects were being seen, no doubt people were interpreting these things all as being ghost rockets. One of the most famous photographs of an alleged ghost rocket that has ever been taken. And if you look on the Wikipedia page for the entry on ghost rockets, you can actually see this. It's most likely a meteor. But that didn't, of course, dissuade people from seeing these things and thinking, yeah, everyone's seeing rockets, that must be one too. So it was probably a mixture of genuine unidentified objects and maybe natural phenomenon as well, but in interpreting that natural phenomena or other circumstances and scenarios, there was the impression of there being a lot more going on than what was actually being reported. Underneath it all, there had to be something, in my way of thinking.
Now you also mentioned that all these rockets tended to land in water.
A lot of them did, you know.
And none were ever recovered, were they?
None were ever recovered. There were some extensive investigations. You know, there was a book called Phenomenon that was edited by the late Hillary Evans that came out a few years ago, and it has contributions from, you know, Klaus Svahn and some of the very best, you know, the Swedish UFO researchers. There was also my good friend Chris Rutkowski who had contributed an article there. But in that book, there is a fantastic essay toward the beginning that looks at the ghost rocket phenomenon that literally, I mean, digs into some of those instances and the investigations of the lakes where people reported seeing these objects crash into. Now, I merely quote other Forteans who in the past have noted the apparent presence of objects crashing into lakes. Ivan Sanderson and John Keel both wrote about this, and I bring that to the table based on their observations. It is true that a lot of the ghost rockets appeared to crash into lakes. The problem with those reports is that there were never any elements of debris that were recovered, that are known to have been recovered. However, in one of the better-known investigations, and again, you know, there's a very, very, very complete description of that investigation given in the aforementioned volume, which is actually a collection of essays called Phenomena. I think the first 50 years is the subtitle of the book, but it's said that not seaweed, I guess, but you know, aqueous plant life, things like that, you know, were scattered on the shore of the lake once investigators got there, and so it looked like some sort of an explosion actually had taken place, despite the fact that they were unable to find any actual shrapnel or debris or anything that was that could be allocated easily to a physical object. It seemed very obvious that some sort of an explosive impact with the water's surface had taken place, and some of the water had been splashed onto shore. They couldn't find evidence of the rocket itself, but something seemed to have crashed into the lake. So it's very interesting that there seems to be kind of what you might call a semi-physical component to the investigations there. It was always something that, like UFOs in general, has remained elusive to investigators. But a point I want to try and make here, and I know, obviously I drive this point home throughout the book, is that, you know, I don't think that we can necessarily assert that these are exotic, truly exotic craft. They resemble Earth technologies too much to really truly be something that I think is alien or exotic. But if we think about in the 1940s in a country like Sweden, there had been reports during the Second World War of what were called Foo Fighters. But the concept of an extraterrestrial intelligence, despite there being possibly investigations and ongoing studies looking into this at the time, and of course, more importantly, afterward, once we get into the late 1940s, because by, you know, literally the summer of 1947, 1 year later, Kenneth Arnold's sighting over Mount Rainier had popularized the idea of there being saucer-like craft, and furthermore, possibly some sort of an aircraft of technologically superior or exotic origin. It wasn't long before people started saying, you know, and Arnold himself said this, he'd walk into the store and people would say, oh, he's the one who's seen the men from Mars. And people made a very distinct logical leap in terms of understanding and perceiving what Arnold may have seen. And even Arnold himself began to speculate, well, maybe he first thought he was seeing military craft, and after it was all said and done, he began to question the extraterrestrial component to it himself. I doubt strongly, though, that during 1946, that the Swedish government, when they were investigating the ghost rockets, I doubt strongly that they were looking at this thing, could we be dealing with something extraterrestrial? It seems very unlikely to me. They were probably concerned about there being a governmental intelligence or a governmental project, rather, that was going on that involved captured missile and rocket programs. So it's very interesting to look at this historically, because we can say today, you know, Soraya and I sitting here talking, oh, we look back and these things were definitely UFOs. Yeah, in proper use of the term, they were. But at the time, I don't think that people in Sweden were looking at these and using the same popular use of the term UFO, because today when we use UFO, we tend to gravitate toward thinking we're talking about spacecraft. I don't, because I know what UFO means and what the term was originally employed to detail. Simply an unidentified flying object. It's a very ambiguous term. No doubt the Swedes looked at it with the same ambiguity at the outset, and I doubt sincerely that there was an extraterrestrial component that they ever considered.
Well, I guess the thing that stands out to me when you say they all go into the water is how many UFO sightings end up going into the water, and B, that, you know, you talk about it being, you know, conventional technology, but we also have seen, like, the airship phenomena and stuff like that, which shows somewhat conventional technology. John Keel talked about different occurrences of airplanes that made no sound, that just kind of glided along without engines or anything else, that seemed to be have some kind of UFO component to them.
Yeah, and Keel and others, of course, have written about the Phantom, the Night Flyers, and the things. There were planes that, rather than there being rockets. I think maybe in the interim between World War I and World War II, there had been a similar wave of flying aircraft of unexplained origin seen over Scandinavia. But these Phantom Flyers or Night Flyers, various different things that they were called, they resembled aircraft, planes, more than rockets. You know, so it's interesting, in that same part of the world, there was a similar phenomenon that had occurred just a few decades or less, you know, just a few years more likely, beforehand. Now, what's interesting is the fact that we do have these reports of aircraft that appear to behave like conventional aircraft, but are said to do really strange things. I've got a good friend and a very reputable you know, person in terms of their, you know, a witness account they would give me. And I, you know, I won't mention her name right now just because I don't know necessarily if this particular report is something she would want produced publicly, you know, with her name appended to it. But I'll just say that she's a fantastic researcher and, you know, someone I would consider a very reliable witness. And she contacted me some time ago to bring to my attention a sighting of what looked like a commercial aircraft that she saw at a low altitude that appeared to be hovering, and it literally flabbergasted her as she saw this. She couldn't fathom what she was seeing or why an aircraft would be in midair and not moving. I mean, it's a very strange thing. There are reports of these kinds of things going on. When it comes to the airship reports, in the 1890s, there are researchers, and I think this has been posted to Anthony Bergaglia's blog a few months back, but there was a link associating the reports of airships at the time in Southern California in the 1890s and actual patents that were filed, and they still exist in the U.S. patent records, for airships that are remarkably similar in their proposed design, not only to the airships that were being seen allegedly over Southern California, but also to some of the, believe it or not, with their long tubular shape and pointed nose in the patent drawings that are provided, they resemble some of the rocket-like craft that were being reported in the 1940s, which I discuss in the Ghost Rockets book. So I've wondered often, and a lot of people say this is really improbable, how a variety of aviation technology could appear and be implemented extra-governmentally by private groups and be withheld and kept from public knowledge. But, you know, when we look at airships, you know, a modern equivalent maybe to the airships of the 1890s are these great big black triangles, which I think, as many ufologists have supposed, that these are probably a DARPA project or something along the lines of what people have called a stealth blimp. I have many personal friends who have observed these craft. I don't doubt that they exist, and frankly, my belief is that they're a government technology, but I wonder if at different periods throughout history there have been extra-governmental programs that nonetheless could be occurring under the guise, or rather under the oversight of a government organization, but subcontracted to different organizations and entities so that government organizations themselves don't have to claim liability for these projects. I know this happens all the time in the world of the black project and black budget. It seems likely to me that, you know, the answer to a lot of the mysteries in the world of UFOs and the reason why some of these things look like conventional aircraft that behave in strange ways is probably because there are entities and organizations that are testing different kinds of aviation technologies, and they're able to keep off the record and out of the history books because of the necessity for secret projects carried out by world governments over the years. It doesn't stretch my brain too far to think that there is an entire chapter or two or three to the history of aviation that most of us are unaware of based on the necessity for secrecy, especially during wartime.
No, I could totally see that. I guess the thing about the airships that stands out to me is what Vallée was talking about, I believe in Dimensions, where he says the interactions with the occupants were very similar to interactions with UFO occupants.
Yeah, I mean, you can't deny that parallel. I'll tell you, my personal interpretation of that is that belies, I guess, more the psychological component, I suppose. The psychological component to this being that I don't doubt that there are instances where an actual technology is occurring here. But the thing is that when we talk about people's alleged encounters, you know, I think that, for instance, there's a legitimate story being told about flying saucers. Whether or not they're actually saucers is debatable, and I've written articles about this just as well. You got to keep in mind the use of the term saucer was in reference to the movement of the craft that Kenneth Arnold saw. He initially described them as being kind of crescent-shaped, and I think that he was both a reliable observer, but someone who also was striving to try and make sense of something he didn't get a fantastic look at. He observed them pretty well, but from a distance. He described the erratic behavior like saucers skipping across water in terms of their flight path. Forever and ever since then, we've talked about flying saucers. And then, within a few short years, we have these contacts in the desert, you know, with George Van Tassel and George Hunt Williamson, and of course, you know, most famously, George Adamski, the three Georges of ufology there, or at least of the contactee era. In all likelihood, it seems very unlikely that those men were having genuine contact with people from Venus or from other planets or from anywhere, you know, for that matter. And although there's some fascinating, compelling, speculative research that Joseph Farrell and others have done, even Joseph he puts out ideas I've noticed in his books that are very compelling in terms of insinuating that maybe that there's a human component to this and a psychological warfare component to it. But by the same token, you know, when I've spoken with Joseph, I interviewed him once. We've emailed just a little. He kind of downplays the idea of there being a literal saucer element. So trying to understand exactly what's going on is very difficult to me. Now, that said, I think that there is a valid real phenomenon. Whether or not we're talking about actual saucers or some sort of other craft that maybe take on varieties of different forms, and that the psychological expectation being this cultural meme of flying saucer, that psychological expectation has to be fulfilled whether or not a person is consciously aware that they're doing it. That sounds, for a lot of people, probably, you know, a proposition that strains credulity, but I mean, the mind really can perceive a lot outside of what is actually happening in these sorts of instances. Now, bringing that back to there being this parallel between the mythology, if you want to call it that stems from the airship era and then the UFO contactees and whatnot, I think we can acknowledge the phenomenon going on, but then also probably a bit of tomfoolery that came out of the mythos that was beginning to build itself around the flying saucer conundrum that occurred during the 1940s and 50s and 60s. And therefore, you have people like George Adamski that were probably more, you know, imaginative storytellers, and maybe people who even to an extent were a little off kilter psychologically and in terms of what they're, you know, I don't want to say that these people were psychotic, but I think, you know, there are a lot of different things that motivate people to tell a story that is not true. And I know I've known good people for years who I know will lie from time to time because they feel perhaps a necessity. They get a fulfillment out of it. They get attention. You know, they have insecurities and they feel that they have to be able to make up for these insecurities. And so they will, you know, stretch the truth sometimes to great degrees. I mean, this is just human nature. It happens. And I think arguably in the midst of an actual phenomenon, there are people who may tell stories that are far beyond what actually has happened. So looking back at those airship stories, it's interesting because Valet compares all these interactions between people and the alleged occupants of these craft. And in a real sense, you know, I mean, again, and I think in practical terms, a scientist as he is should maybe look at these things. And rather than refuting them outright, let's look at them for what they are and see if we can find parallels. But two assertions can be made about those parallels, that there is a consistency in the mythologies, but that also that this consistency could also be consistent with psychological behavior that surrounds UFO flaps. Certain people will come out of the woodwork and make claims that they have had contact with and encounters with beings that are as wild and fanciful as anything that you'd read in science fiction magazines. It could be that there were George Adamskis in the 1890s as well who were claiming to have had contact with these beings. That may be bunk. That's unfortunately what we probably have to assume. That's the most likely and probable solution to the thing to me. But that these stories that were more outlandish could have had basis in the factual presence of an actual airship that was being seen around the time. And I don't think that we can rule out all of the newspaper reports and all of the witness testimonies that have come out during that period. I think that there are, if not many, at least a handful of reports that are more compelling. And J. Allen Danilek wrote a fantastic book about that a few years ago. I think the 1897 airship mystery. And he's chronicled the possibility of there being an actual nascent technology existing in the United States, which if you got, and this is the final point I'll make about the airships, you know, we see a technology that people said did not exist in 1897 that was allegedly being recounted in newspaper reports. And everybody tries to say that this is nothing that can be proven and thereby it's most likely newspaper hoaxes and bunk. But actually, contrary to most aviation historians and what they will tell you, Danilek in his book dug up the fact that indeed there were actually tests of, and some of them successful, tests with early prototypes for what would later become dirigibles, zeppelins, and other kinds of airships taking place in Germany and parts of Europe at the time. They weren't widely publicized, but they are known. And Danilek, in his research, nonetheless, was able to document within just a few years of, and even some coinciding at least early tests with the airship sightings of the 1890s, the tests that were occurring in Germany were to a certain extent successful. And by the same token, many aviation professionals today and historians are unaware to an extent that these were going on, despite the documented evidence. So sometimes I think that what has to come into question is if we want to be able to find the truth, we have to be able to know where to look. And it's not that people are uneducated, but it's just that there are aspects and elements of history that we still are trying to uncover and still things that we're trying to find. We haven't assembled a full story yet. And even something as recent as aviation history that has occurred only in the last, I mean, you know, just a little over 100 years, this is still something that we're kind of putting together the story because there may be aspects of it that have gone unreported or underreported and the mainstream may have looked over. If we had the full story, we would probably have a clearer picture of maybe what was occurring in the 1890s with some of those airship reports.
And I'm sure that's entirely possible. I've always wondered that myself because it wasn't that far off from when we had our own actual airships. But I also still stick to that you can't just dismiss the strange reports. It's kind of like what nuts and bolts UFO researchers do, where they just throw out the high strangeness reports and assume that those are people making them up, and they may not be.
I'm sorry, you're right. You know, I've grown more skeptical over time because of, you know, my own interest and leanings in this, and I think that offends a lot of people. And I don't mean to be offensive, and not with you, but I mean, you know, with other people. You know, you and I could bat ideas back and forth all day. That's pretty obvious. That's why you keep having me back. But But you know, you're right. I think that by the same token, and I'll quote a skeptical friend of mine, Sharon Hill. She had written a piece for the Huffington Post about attending a paranormal conference. Now, Sharon, of course, is very skeptical, and yet I also knew her to be a person from personal correspondences, and you see also things that she tweets about it. She's regularly frustrated with the way that the subject of cryptozoology is printed or presented today. She has an issue with, for instance, the presentation that we see on a program like Finding Bigfoot versus legitimate credentialed researchers who are trying to study and present a logical, scientific, academic approach to the study of cryptozoology. I don't think that Sharon's someone, although many... She's not all that demonized in the community, and I, you know, frankly, would demonize anyone who would demonize her. I've always liked Sharon, and I think that she brings a lot of really good, hard-lined, skeptical and needed skeptical perspective to the paranormal phenomenon. And yet, by the same token, I don't think she's someone who's ready to discount every report of a Bigfoot. I know in her youth, she read a lot of these books years ago. She's been fascinated with this subject for a long time. She's become more skeptical because of the way so much of this is presented. But deep down, like the Goodalls out there and like the John Napiers and like, you know, Micah Hanks here, I think we all want to know that there's a, or want to believe that there's a phenomenon, but we want better evidence for the existence of that phenomenon. Now, Sharon was writing for the Huffington Post, and she had said that, you know, going to a paranormal event, she says, sometimes I have to go into these events and turn off the skepticism and just listen to these people. And she says, how dare we tell these people who say they've had these experiences that they didn't have that experience? I wish more skeptics today would take that kind of an attitude, because just because you or I haven't had an experience doesn't mean it didn't happen. And I'll never, ever, ever say that a person, despite, I think, the dubious nature of a lot of the alleged contactee cases of the golden age of ufology, you know, again, maybe George Adamski actually, let's say, was having experiences where he was meeting beings in the desert. Maybe he wasn't just lying. I mean, I suspect he was lying. But maybe he wasn't. Maybe he was having a valid experience and a valid interaction of some kind, even if it were purely psychological. But he felt that there was a legitimate physical phenomenon occurring before him. That does not remove the possibility that he could have been reporting to the best of his ability, depending on his mental state, what was occurring in his life and what he was perceiving around him, you know. Now, you know, again, that doesn't remove the possibility of a physical phenomenon or an unphysical phenomenon, non-physical, semi-quasi-physical, as Valet would often say. You know, there are some pretty high strangeness reports that come out over the, you know, that have come out over the course of time, and we can't rule those out. We can't look at all the Dover demons. We can't look at all the Flatwoods monsters. We can't look at all the Mothmen and the hairy bipeds. And we can't say that people consistently always make up these kinds of stories. Because frankly, you know, while I say that we should be skeptical about our approach in studying these things, by the same token, the plethora of information available to us seems to indicate more than just a mythology based solely on hoaxes. I frankly think that that's impossible, and just as impossible as some of the more credulous reports that people have held onto for over the years. So there's got to be balance. There really does. And yeah, you're totally right, Sarai. You cannot throw out the baby with the bathwater, even when trying to be skeptical. But the only reason, and I'll say this too about skepticism, the only reason I have gravitated more toward what the skeptics really don't call skeptical. Modern skeptics don't think I'm a skeptic at all. They laugh when I say I'm skeptical. I maintain I'm skeptical because I'm not going to dismiss the phenomenon and try and make a name for myself as a writer as being another one of these guys that can effectively debunk every claim of the extraordinary. Because frankly, I'm sorry, that's a subjective circumstance. That's a subjective approach. Any person who thinks that they can say, okay, what this person says happened to them simply didn't. How do you prove it? Because they can't prove it. You know, that may not be, I'm sorry, and I don't think that in every instance that, well, they can't prove it and therefore I don't have to. That's not a strong enough argument to present against the existence of a phenomenon. Many modern debunkers and skeptics think that that's the way that we have to be. If they can't prove it, they're the ones making the incredible claim. I don't have to prove their incredible claim, and therefore they're wrong, I'm right. That doesn't get us any further. You know, that's getting into a philosophical debate of sorts. In other words, it's going to say that you may have had an extraordinary experience, but since you can't prove it, according to conventional standards, it doesn't exist, and I therefore say you're wrong. You know, again, coming back to Sharon, who are we to say that those people didn't have those experiences? And in doing so, it is, to an extent maybe, intellectually dishonest, because what we do is we remove ourselves from having to think more deeply about what the experience underlying actually entails, and what the phenomenon that could be present, that people are perceiving. You know, if we remove it from our culture and don't have to think about it at all, sure, that makes it really easy for us if we want to call ourselves skeptics and just debunk all possibility of things that may seem extraordinary. But, you know, it's intellectually dishonest. It's also intellectually a bit lazy, too, because we're removing so that we don't have to deal with it. You know, if we really want to be honest, we have to accept the possibility, but we have to be skeptical in our approach so that we don't fall through the great big gaping hole in our heads.
And the thing too about George Adamski is he very obviously faked photographs and did stuff that was clearly a hoax, as opposed to people who don't necessarily seem like they're hoaxing things. And maybe George Adamski had one event that set this all off, and then he continued to create a story around it from that point on, too.
It's funny because, yeah, that's something I think that has to be taken into consideration. I've seen a lot of people. I wouldn't call Kenneth Arnold a hoaxer, but see, I think Kenneth Arnold had a legitimate encounter where he saw something that truly was strange. I don't know that necessarily based on his explanation that we can rule out something of this world. He, at the outset, perceived what he had seen had been some sort of military aircraft. But it didn't match, you know, and still doesn't match any known aircraft that existed at that time. Interestingly, much like the ghost rockets, which resembled cruise missiles a few decades before they were commonly in use by government agencies and military operations and the like, interestingly, we could perceive, especially what Kenneth Arnold initially reported seeing in 1947, as being similar to certain aircraft that exist today, but again, would not have existed for several decades. And we may not be able to say there's a clear match for any known aircraft today, but I mean, certainly what he saw is similar to a lot of these flying wing craft, you know, that even the Germans have begun to develop. It's just, you know, the maneuverability, the speed at which they were flying, the general shape, it didn't match any known aircraft at that time. So I'm always fascinated when I hear about reports of technology that people have claimed that they've seen that a few decades later shows up, but it couldn't have existed at the time that it was seen. Ghost rockets fit that criteria. So did what Kenneth Arnold saw. And yet, after a few weeks even, it was probably just a few short weeks, I'm sure that there were a lot of people in the press, a lot of, you know, researchers, Ray Palmer, of course, that went on to found Fate magazine. He, of course, took Arnold under his wing to an extent. And I think that the insinuation that this was some sort of otherworldly or extraordinary paranormal even phenomenon going on, I think that expectation, because he was presented with that from all angles, from all different directions, Kenneth Arnold, no doubt, to an extent, whether knowingly or unknowingly, he caved to that and began to even speculate about the extraterrestrial component himself. Now, the reason I bring that up again is because if we look at someone like George Adamski, it's very likely that a person could have maybe had an experience, and then they feel a certain pressure to cave to conventional expectations. And furthermore, if they want to maintain their moment in the spotlight, could a person who has had an initial valid experience of some variety or believe that they had, would they go to great lengths to try and convince people that they have had ongoing encounters, that they are indeed special? Yeah, I think a lot of people do that. I think a lot of our UFO abductees and people like that, you know, they may be good people, but I think that a lot of them may have had an initial original encounter, and they have, I mean, who's to say that they don't have nightmares and dreams that mimic the experience that they had, and they have this perception that they've had ongoing experiences throughout their lives. Not to say that some people haven't, I don't know. But certainly there is a, you know, a factor, there's a, you know, kind of a an imposition on people who have had an extraordinary experience, and they want to be able to, you know, live a normal life, but they also want acceptance. And maybe in the sense of wanting to be able to feel accepted, they get into a position where they have a bit of pressure put on them to have to kind of replicate that experience that brought them into, public attention and notoriety and fame. You know, some people don't want that fame. Others, I think, crave it, and, you know, they'll do anything they can to continue that.
All right, we've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Micah Hanks.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, links section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And you are listening to Where Did the Road Go? And our guest tonight is Micah Hanks. And we've been talking, well, we've been talking a little bit about his book, The Ghost Rockets, but we've gone way off the path at this point. And one of the things I wanted to ask you to explain to people, you used the term Fortean, and I've used it plenty of times, and I always take for granted that people know what that means. But I'm guessing a good number of our listeners may not know what that means. So do you want to explain the term Fortean and where it comes from?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, of course, this is a reference to Charles Hoy Fort, who was, you know, around the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century. Fort had been the chronicler of strange phenomena. I think he had had managed to inherit a fairly decent sum of money, and so Fort, throughout his middle life, was able to devote a lot of time to basically what no one else at that time had done. That was essentially becoming a full-time collector and chronicler of unexplained phenomena. And since he was the first person really that did that, many people have used the expression Fortean in order to reference, on the whole, the study and the collecting and the categorizing and chronicling of inexplicable events, odd and quirky encounters, strange things that happened. Now, back in his day, Fort certainly probably talked about things seen in the sky and whatnot, but I mean, the majority of the things that Fort wrote about, and he had published in a number of books and volumes, Book of the Damned, Low, you know, some of these different things, and a lot of them have been compiled and presented in you know, singular large volumes that have his collected works and the like. But, you know, Fort often focused on things like snakes, you know, amphibians, fish falling from the sky, and also the especially for the heavy metal audience, something that people would recognize as being raining blood. This is also something that he documented pretty frequently. Now I'll tell you a really brief and funny story about that. I wrote an article a couple of years ago called Fortean disappearances that have kept us guessing. Fortean referencing strange disappearances, not just a person who went to the store, they disappeared, the car was found. You know, I mean, I'm talking, you know, stories about people who allegedly were, you know, walking across a field and then vanished. That particular story, by the way, is a famous one, a famous urban legend of a man who disappeared in his front yard. And it's actually just that, it's an urban legend. I don't think there's any truth to it, but there are some more perplexing disappearances that have taken place over time. And when I wrote the article, somebody, you know, tried to rather snarkily correct my spelling and said 14, and they wrote in parentheses, 1-4 is spelled F-O-U-R. And I'm like, and they had no idea what Fortean was. They thought I was trying to say 14. And I said, you know, I said, thank you for trying to correct my spelling, but I need to point out to you, by the way, that if you read the article, there are only 5 or 6 disappearances listed, so one of us can't count, and the other doesn't know what the, you know, what the word I was trying to employ is. So,
nice.
Yeah. So that's what Fortean means.
All right. One of the things you mentioned in the introduction to the book is these spirals that happened over Norway. Everything always happens over Scandinavia. Why is that?
That's interesting because in that instance, and there have been people who have kind of debated that with me and said that they didn't buy the I think actually, as a matter of fact, my buddy Jim Harold, who does the Paranormal Podcast, I think he'd been one of the ones that that was somewhat skeptical of the official explanation of the Norway spiral that occurred, I believe, in 2010. But the official, I guess it was 2010. I'm pretty sure. But anyway, so looking back, the official explanation had been that there had been a missile launch and that the missile malfunctioned and spiraled, and that the appearance of the spiral in the sky had been this missile as it was flying. Obviously, that spiral only would have been probably visible from certain locales, but over Scandinavia, it was, you know, especially Norway, it was particularly apparent and bright. What we got to keep in mind about that, by the way, is that if that object was seen over Norway and had been, you know, fired from a test launch that the Russians were doing, it seems entirely plausible that some of the ghost rocket reports from back in the 1940s were of possible origins similar to that. But there have been people, despite the official, and this is the thing that's important about this. The reason that we have to take into consideration the errant missile launch or the compromised missile launch hypothesis is because in conjunction with the appearance of the spiral over Norway, the Russians had acknowledged that there had been a missile test going on, and furthermore, that it had spiraled out of control because of some sort of a mechanical failure on board the actual guidance system of the missile, which caused it to, rather than flying true, it began to spiral. Despite the acknowledgement by the Russian officials who had said, yes, that was our missile, there have been people who have said, I don't know, though, that just looks too weird. I don't think we can rule that. That could be an actual UFO. I don't think there's a UFO there at all. It was an unidentified flying object until the Russians claimed it.
Well, to me, it never looked like a UFO, but at the same time, the Russians also initially denied it, didn't they?
Well, you know, and I think that they'll always initially deny it until they, you know, either have to come forward and give an explanation. The thing is that, you know, when there is a missile launch, especially a missile launch that appears to have involved a mechanical failure that some people at the outset might have perceived as being something that could have been potentially dangerous. Oh, you guys were testing missiles and the thing went awry as it was flying through the air. Well, what if it had come down and hit the mainland? What if it had landed in Norway and harmed or hurt somebody? I mean, you know, when something like that happens, it's much more difficult for a government to say, yeah, sorry, our bad. You know, so, I mean, I think that deniability at the outset is the standard. There was a situation also that occurred over Newfoundland, I guess, a few years ago, where I talked about this in the introduction of the book just as well. There were photographs taken of a large missile flying over Newfoundland. I think it was seen in parts of Canada and whatnot. And there was a woman who had actually taken the photographs of this thing, and she was visited by a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer, and he confirmed that it had been a French missile test. And then that was denied by the French. The French denied that that had been the case. So, I mean, it's quite common in these reports where these missiles turn up where you'll get conflicting accounts where someone will say, oh, yeah, this is what this is, and, you know, such and such is, you know, admitted. They admitted what they said that they were supposed to be seeing. And then later on down the road, the admission is denied or it is withdrawn. You know, I mean, and I think that generally that comes from a lot of confusion that begins. I mean, again, the Canadian missile incident wasn't one of the only ones in modern times, and it's funny because I looked at a lot of these in the introduction to the book to kind of, you know, showcase the fact that, you know, the missile phenomenon in modern times is still very apparent. And then in the first chapter we go back to 1946 and take this chronological viewpoint that brings us back up to the present. But, you know, one of the other instances that we look at in the introduction when we're giving this kind of presentation on some of the modern, most of them explained, but some of them actually containing actual missiles, there was this California coast incident from a couple of years ago where there was what was believed to be a missile firing up off the Canadian or the Southern California coast around sundown. You know, there were news choppers that captured the footage and whatnot, and even I think a former defense official who had said that this might be a display of power immediately prior to President Obama's tour of Asia. It was later determined, utilizing meteorological data, that almost without any question that had just been a commercial jet, but that the way that the sun illuminated the contrail being produced by the jet, and also the way that it appeared over the horizon, gave the impression of something rising up out of the water, whereas it had literally been traveling over out of the Pacific Ocean and headed toward the mainland, and it gave the impression of something going up rather than flying over. Meteorological data determined otherwise later, and yet still people had tried to make the claim that this was a missile. So what's really interesting is in some of these instances, we are dealing with real missiles, but in others, there's the perception of a missile-like object that is later proven not to be. And it's interesting because in every case you look at, there's always this diversity of opinions on what people have actually seen. Some people want to say, no, I think really what I saw really was a missile. Some people want to say, no, it wasn't. Government agencies will either come forward and say, yeah, it was us, or they won't, or vice versa, or they'll change the story. This sort of thing happens all the time, and I think that a lot of the time that the reason for that is just it's an attempt, a conscious attempt to, you know, to maintain damage control. You don't want a situation to get out of hand, especially if it involves something along the lines of a missile test launch that fails and that could involve something that may even be harmful not only to the people of a nation that launched the weapon, but also other nations, because that could lead to an act of war if perceived as such.
Now, I might be remembering wrong, but weren't there more than one Norway spiral?
There was one significant one, and I seem to recall that there may have been a report a less publicized report of something similar that could have taken place in conjunction with another test launch. I know that the same phenomenon has occurred over China in a number of instances just as well, with, well, or similar phenomena, I'll say, because there have been everything from natural phenomena, comets and meteors and missiles and everything have been attributed to phenomena that in ufological resources you'll find, spiral objects seen in the sky that have appeared over parts of China and things like that. So I think that the spiral phenomena has been reported in a number of instances. Most often it has to do with meteors and, or I'm sorry, with missiles and missile tests and things like that. But, you know, I don't know that there was another widely publicized incident that took place over Norway. It just seems like there may have been something. I'll have to dig into that and try and find out.
All right. One of the things I wanted to get to before we run out of time here is the TWA 800 scenario. And I wasn't aware that there were missile sightings before and after this, as well as during the time that that plane had exploded.
Yeah, and that's something that's often systematically overlooked. I think that in some cases, there's this documentary that was produced by, I think it was the Starz television, the movie network. I think it was an original documentary presentation that they did. And I was able to see it back during the fall. Fabulous, fabulous documentary if you haven't seen it, and I really recommend it to people. It's very interesting because I think that there are some very compelling data that's brought to the table. And during an interview on Megyn Kelly's program on Fox News, one of the physicists, not a government employee or anything like that. He's a civilian physicist, but he took a personal interest in the TWA Flight 800 crash. And he was in this interview featured, and this is something that can be found on YouTube, but the gentleman is talking with the FBI director who had overseen the TWA Flight 800 investigation, at which time the man had stated that he thought that people who have come forward now and changed their determinations about what they had investigated and what they had determined about TWA Flight 800, people, he said, that were not brave enough to do it when they were afraid of losing their jobs or whatnot because of the political backlash of saying a missile had happened. He says that, you know, they were cowards and that these people should have said something when the investigation was actually ongoing, as opposed to, you know, 15 years or whatever later. That was 1996, so I guess we're looking at, what would that be? Actually, gosh, we're coming up on, with it being 2014, you know, we're looking at almost two decades now.
Yeah.
So, but again, you know, he was very, initially he plays down in this interview segment the idea of there being any conspiracy and says, I'm sorry, the report was there. We all looked into this. The FBI had considered a missile possibility early on and, you know, we ruled that out. But that after being approached during the interview with the possibility that there's new evidence, he says, you know, well, you know, I don't think it's very, very noble of these people to come out, you know, two decades later almost and have, you know, changed that story, which is an interesting statement because think about what's being implied here. You know, well, okay, maybe there is evidence that is contrary to the official determination about what brought down TWA Flight 800. And yet, we can't acknowledge that now because the official investigation didn't take place, but we'll ridicule people who come forward and try and offer that investigation or that information now that there won't be so much political backlash. They should have been brave and should have said that then if they had knowledge. And I'm just thinking, guys, you know, maybe it's not that easy. You know, one of the issues that a lot of these investigators had claimed that they had faced was that they didn't have access to all the information that they needed, but that they felt adamant that the FBI had been withholding certain information about the investigation and that there was very little that they could do apart from what the FBI allowed them to do and what the FBI allowed them to investigate. And now, years later, many of these people have come on the record and said, yeah, we felt that, you know, the FBI was controlling aspects of this investigation. And again, specifically, the other they I'm talking about is the National Transportation Safety Board, who had been involved with the investigation. They handle aircraft, they handle crashes and investigation for the cause of crashes. The FBI, of course, was investigating this because a civilian aircraft had gone down. Many people would claim that they'd seen an object maybe headed toward it, a missile-like object, and of course they were investigating the possibility of there being a terrorist act. So, and the FBI really kind of had a stranglehold on that. So I recommend that documentary to anybody who'd like to see it. And there's some very compelling data that comes out of it. One thing they don't address, though, And maybe that's because they're trying to focus on the actual investigation and what may have been left out and maybe what could have been, to use the popular conspiratorial term, covered up. What they do not address is something that circumstantially, I think, has to be taken into consideration when looking, you know, historically at TWA Flight 800. And that is that if we say that there's a single missile incident that people claim that they witnessed taking down a plane over, I guess it's Long Island Sound, right near JFK Airport where they've been flying out of. If they witness a single incident where an object of some sort appears to be flying toward an aircraft and then it explodes and goes down, that's one thing. The problem with the TWA Flight 800 situation is that, yes, as you know, we've talked about already, that there were incidents in the months leading up to and even after TWA Flight 800 where air traffic control was in contact with pilots that observed what appeared to be rockets or missiles flying dangerously close to their aircraft as they were departing JFK Airport and flying over Long Island Sound. There were probably about three or four incidents, and I document those in a chapter in the Ghost Rockets book. So if we look at in terms of a series of reports of alleged rockets or missiles that were reported by trained pilots and their crews flying over Long Island Sound in the months before and after the TWA Flight 800, and look at the TWA Flight 800 crash in the context of a series of reports of similar objects and near misses, you know, that brings another compelling and disturbing elements to this. And I asked people, you know, I'm not trying to tell you that a shoulder mounted missile or something like that brought down TWA Flight 800, but you know, look at what independent investigators and also NTSB researchers have come on the record and said now. Look at the stories and the reports that have been gathered by Boston Air Traffic Control and other, as a matter of fact, there was an Association of Retired Aviation Professionals. It was an organization that was formed by a former crash investigator named Bill Donaldson. They also dug up a number of the reports of missiles that were seen around the time or objects like missiles. Look at the new evidence with TWA Flight 800 in conjunction with the missile reports. And please just, I think anyone would probably see a dangerous pattern there. And without going into the TWA Flight 800 conspiracies themselves in the Ghost Rockets, I've looked at those rocket reports, and I think that at very least people do need to look at those things in conjunction with the possibility that we haven't gotten the full explanation of the TWA Flight 800 crash. There's something going on, and that pattern is very disturbing to me.
And why would we have these missile launches, and why would nobody look into them?
Who would be launching the missile? That's another thing.
Yeah.
See, that's the issue, is that there was always this conspiratorial attitude that there'd been a Navy ship out there in Long Island Sound that had been launching test missiles, and one accidentally took down TWA Flight 800. And I find that unlikely because, I mean, the thing is over a well-trafficked civilian airspace. These are flight paths that are going to be known to military and naval operations. They're not going to be out there near one of the most heavily trafficked commercial airports in the United States, or you know, and probably the most on the East Coast. They're not going to be out there testing missiles in an area like that. And the idea that a Navy test accidentally brought down an airplane, I mean, that sounds absurd to me. And I think probably Bill Donaldson and the retired aviation professionals that he assembled, who began their own independent investigation, I think that they leaned more toward the idea of an actual act of terror that had been carried out by someone who probably was utilizing a shoulder-mounted missile. I think their feeling was that it could have been launched from a boat on Long Island Sound, but that somebody launched a missile at this craft. Now, if people want to look at the broader rocket phenomenon that we look at in the Ghost Rockets book that is, you know, stemmed from, and again, I don't think that all these cases of rockets that I discuss in the book are in any way, and I don't try to push this idea either, that they're all one singular phenomenon that's being documented. We're documenting cases that involve projectiles over the years, over the decades, that probably stem from a variety of sources. But if you want to look at things in the broader picture, you know, these reports of rockets that can fly and do strange things and that carry on strange little tactical maneuvers and all this kind of stuff. A really good one was reported that took place over the Bahamas in the 1980s, and I discussed that in the book. Some of these objects behave in ways that are not consistent with most missiles and rockets and things like that. Where do these objects come from? Who is controlling them? What are they, and why are they being flown or tested? And most importantly, and coming back to what you were just asking, Soraya, why do they appear over Long Island Sound you know, in the months and weeks leading up to and after the TWA Flight 800 crash. I mean, somebody has to be behind this, but, you know, that's the last place that rockets and missiles of any kind need to be flying. You know, it just doesn't happen. So I don't think that there's much credibility to the idea of a you know, nuclear sub surfacing and testing a rocket, you know, in an area like that. You know, the idea of military tests going on in those kind of areas is pretty absurd, but we can't rule out the possibility that somebody or someone had been involved in a rocket or a missile launch. And that's why there have been many people who have said that, yeah, perhaps a shoulder-mounted missile, you know, a weaponized kind of a situation like that very well could have been at play.
And the bigger question is, why weren't these investigated before they hit the plane?
Why don't any of you people who are... Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing is I would love to... There is mention of, because of a number of objects seen in the sky, and they lean heavily toward, you know, meteorological data. I mean, we're talking about, like, natural phenomena, meteors, you know, things like that, over the northeastern skies. They do mention that in the NTSB report, and therefore the... Due to the prevalence of meteor sightings at the time, the possibility of a meteor striking the plane was investigated, too. But think about this. It was found to be statistically almost impossible, not impossible, almost impossible statistically for a meteor to strike a moving plane, and that was ruled out. And yet, according to the report, that was nonetheless something that was explored. In other words, they were looking into the possibility that some sort of a flying object collided with the plane, and that is what can be directly inferred from aspects of the investigation that was released in the official TWA Flight 800 NTSB report. Now, then again, that's maybe not all that revelatory because, as we know, the FBI from the outset had been concerned and stated publicly that they were afraid a missile could have taken down the plane. After their investigation, they claimed that that wasn't the case and that they have no evidence that supports that. I think that there is some evidence to the contrary that shows that there was possibly an explosion that occurred outside the craft that brought down the plane. And again, this new documentary on the STARS network, the TWA Flight 800 documentary, I mean, it provides, again, what I I'm pretty skeptical about these sorts of things. I was surprised. I expected that I was going to probably think that this was really, you know, a very conspiratorial, you know, presentation. It wasn't as conspiratorial and sensational, I guess, is what I'm thinking. As you'd think, it was a very reasonable presentation that seemed to have a lot of good data that has to be taken into consideration. But here's what I believe, and this is the thing. I've often been criticized, for not putting my opinions out there, and the reason why is because if we don't have a full data set, I don't believe that, you know, we're lending anything to the argument by making bold suppositions. And if I've only got so much data with regard to a certain topic or a certain investigation or a certain element, you know, with regard to ufology or something, you know, I can only speculate so far. Data will only carry us so far, and we can only go so far based on what data we have available to us. Now, with TWA Flight 800, there's an overwhelming amount of data to me that points to there being some sort of an object that collided with that plane. But why, again, certain aspects of this continue to be overlooked, it continues to, you know, to baffle me. And the only way I can perceive this is that there are people who just don't want to acknowledge an attack or an accident, a grave, a horrible accident that may have occurred. And no doubt people are going to say that there's a cover-up or that they were trying to hide something. For what reason, I don't know, but one thing that seems pretty clear is that I don't think that, you know, the official investigation that occurred around the time of the crash is right.
All right. Well, your new book is The Ghost Rockets, Mysterious Missiles and Phantom Projectiles in Our Skies. We've been talking with Micah Hanks, and there was one. You do deal with some UFO-type encounters in here, as well as real missiles. And there was one that really amused me where a plane almost hit an inflatable shark and mistook it for a missile somehow.
Yeah.
But, all right. So what do you have coming up? Anything people should know about?
Oh, gosh. You know, everything and nothing all at once, as you know. I'm going to be going on what's called the Ancient Alien Cruise, which is interesting. And although it's called the Ancient Alien Cruise, I think that's a popular subject these days. David Hatcher Childress will be with us, Dr. Robert Schock, Hugh Newman, and I. My lecture's going to be on, and again, it's going to be what I think is a very fair and balanced presentation on the idea of giant skeletons that have been unearthed throughout the Americas. This is a fascinating subject to me. Of greater interest to me is probably, while there's a lot of data about giant skeletons in the Americas, I'm more interested sometimes in some of the reports of skeletons and skeletal remains that have been uncovered in other parts of the world. especially the, for instance, at Castelnau, France. I think that there was a case where there were fragments of a skeletal body, Bronze Age skeletal remains that pointed to an individual that could have been in excess of 11 feet tall. Robert Wadd, wow. The tallest human to exist in modern times was only 8 foot 11. I mean, we're talking, and it's funny because a skeptical approach to this is that, well, you know, 8 feet tall, 9 feet tall, even, you know, that's nothing that has not existed in modern times. Technically, Robert Wadlow was not 9 feet tall. And so in my opinion, if you find a skeleton that's 9 feet tall, that's not beyond the realm of the possible. But when we get into the realm of 10 and 11 and 14 and 15 foot tall skeletons, if there's any truth at all to the claims of these skeletal discoveries, we have to take into consideration something that, yeah, I would be comfortable calling anomalous. And so I'm going to be presenting a lecture on whether or not there's, you know, credibility behind those claims, and looking on the whole at the historical, you know, study and discussion of the alleged giants that existed in the Americas and perhaps elsewhere. That's what I'll be talking about on the Ancient Alien Cruise. And then after that, who knows? Gosh, so much going on, but glad 2014's here. And as a friend of mine said, let's go ahead and drive a stake through 2013 to make sure it's gone.
And you got three radio shows, Micah Hank's program, the Degrelian Report, and Middle Theory.
Right.
And people can find all this at MicahHanks.com?
That is correct, my friend.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Micah, and have a good cruise. And maybe we'll have you back to talk about giants at some point.
Well, let's do that. You know, we should just make that the next topic of discussion. I'm sure I can ramble on about that as well as the best of them.
All right. Thank you so much. Actually, would you like to sign out on your Never Without You song again?
Oh, we could do that if you'd like.
Because we did this on the midweek podcast, but we didn't play it on the full radio show.
Ah, well, we can do that. Maybe the radio listeners would enjoy to hear that. Yeah.
Want to give us a quick recap on this?
Yes. The famous story of Frederick Valentich has always fascinated me, and I'd written a song a while back that, and I'm working on a lot of stuff. In fact, just today, with everything else going on, I'm kind of in the planning stages of trying to get a full length album done. Because, as many people know, I split my time between being a singer and a guitarist and performing an awful lot, and then also writing and researching. So it's a very interesting life I lead, and a very busy one. And every now and then there's a little crossover. And so in this instance, this is a song that I wrote that is based loosely on the Frederick Valentich disappearance. In 1978, Valentich was flying over the Bass Strait in a little Cessna aircraft, and he contacted Melbourne Air Traffic Control and reported a green object that was flying and doing what we could only describe as aerial acrobatics around his craft. Shortly thereafter, he reports to Melbourne Air Traffic Control that the object was hovering over him and that it wasn't an aircraft. And then Valentich shortly thereafter lost radio contact, or rather Melbourne lost radio contact with Valentich. He disappeared and was never found again. And I think that there's a genuine mysterious disappearance right there, if there ever was one. Stories always fascinated me, and therefore with the coinciding with the release of the Valentich files by the Australian government, I wrote this song that quotes Valentich, according to his girlfriend, after he disappeared. She was interviewed, and it was known that Valentich had an interest in UFOs. And he had told his girlfriend once, she'd asked him, would you ever get on a UFO if you were given an opportunity? Would you take a ride on a spaceship? And he said, well, I'd go if I could take you with me, but never without you.
And hence, nice. All right, thank you, Micah. Here's Never Without You.
Last night, standing by our wishing well, tossing coins at the water's edge like some fable only your eyes could tell. I know you told me you couldn't dance, but now I've learned that that's not true. That's why I'll go if you'll come along, but never without you. No, never. No, never without you. No, never without you. Let's be free and steal the night like like lovers always do. And yeah, there were times that doubt came to mind, but I never questioned you. The hidden flame inside my heart keeps burning tried and true. And the letter there by the candle reads that I'm never without you. No, never, no, never without you. No, never, no, never without you. Spare me for my innocence, forgive my wicked name. For the Lord knows the times where I could have tried, but I stumbled all the same. We all have purpose in this life, there are things we're meant to do. And one bright day I'll be coming home, but never without you. No, never, no, never without you. No, never, no, never without you. No, never. Chased you through a dream I had, I thought I'd been deceived. But a smile when I realized before my eyes that my message had been received. You were asking where I had been, if this world of ours was through. Then the Lord came and said we'd be fine instead, just as long as I'm with you. No, never, no, never without you. Skipping stones by our wishing well tonight. The same empty space that I always trace when we dance in the pale moonlight. I made reservations in my mind the way I always do. And there'll be a light when you come back tonight. Then I'm never without you. No, never.